Well, this morning we find ourselves in the parsha called Vayetse, and Genesis 28, starting in verse 10. And as we do each week, here's an outline of the events, just a very rough outline of the events in this Torah portion. In chapter 28, we have Jacob's dream of the ladder, the sulam. And what a powerful, powerful image this is. This is another one of those things of if I looked at the book of Genesis or even the Torah as being a mountain range, this would be another one of those peaks. You know, Genesis 15, where God makes the blood covenant with Abraham, and then Genesis 22, where Abraham takes Isaac up to Mount Moriah to offer him. This is another peak, this dream that Jacob has of the ladder. In chapter 29, he meets his future bride, Rachel, and meets her father, Laban, and then there's the horrible honeymoon. He marries Rachel, only to find out in the morning it wasn't Rachel, it was Leah. So he gets cheated out of an extra 7 years of work to get both of these brides. In chapter 30, we see that Jacob and Leah and the handmaids did not have the problem that Abraham and Sarah had and Isaac and Rebekah had. You find the matriarchs being barren for the most part. But boy, then Jacob comes along and he has 11 sons there in just in one chapter, and number 12 on his way. And then he gets ready to leave. But then Laban says, no, let's work out a deal here. And so he stays for another 6 years. Then in chapter 31, Jacob and his family finally leave Laban. They just get up and take off. Laban finds out, chases him down, and he's angry as a nest of hornets. But they make a covenant. And then Jacob continues to make his way on back to his homeland after 20 years of absence. Now, let's just start with chapter 28. We're going to read the first few verses of the Torah portion. So it begins in chapter 28, verse 10. Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He encountered Hamakom, the place. And we believe this place is also Mount Moriah, the same place where Abraham took Isaac to offer him, the same place where the temple was later built, same place where Yeshua was later crucified. We can't be 100% certain, but tradition teaches us that this is the same place. There is support in the scriptures, but I believe it is. But we can discuss that at another time. He encountered the place and spent the night there because the sun had set. He took from the stones of Hamakom, the place, which he arranged around his head, and laid down in that Makom, that place. The word place is used three times. And dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward. So it's anchored in heaven, but its bottom is pointing down to the earth. Its top reached heavenward, and behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it. They were going up and coming down. Now, you could also read that they were ascending, descending on him. That word can be translated either way. Keep that in mind. Verse 13, and behold, Adonai was standing over him. And he said, I am Adonai, God of Abraham, your father, and God of Isaac. The ground upon which you are lying, to you will I give it and to your descendants. Oh, we're having issues with these screens. Okay. But Tim's going to fix it, aren't you, Tim? Uh-oh, that doesn't sound, when he's quiet like that, it's always trouble. Let's see what happens. So I'm going to continue reading. And it says, ground upon which you are aligned, to you will I give it and to your descendants. Your offspring shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out powerfully westward, eastward, northward, and southward. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and by your seed. Behold, I am with you. That's important to remember. Jacob's going to go through hell and back over the next few chapters. But God says, I'm with you. Behold, he may pay attention. I am with you. I will guard you wherever you go. I will return you to this soil. I know Jacob must have replayed these words over and over and over again over the course of the next 20 years. For I will not forsake you until I will have done what I have spoken about you. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, here's his first statement. Surely Adonai is present in this place, and I did not know it. How many times each of us could have said the same thing? You go through some tragedy, and then somehow God shows up, and you look back at the tragedy and realize, God was in this place, and I didn't know it. And then the second statement, he says, he became frightened and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. Jacob arose early in the morning, took the stone that he placed around his head, set it up as a pillar. He poured oil on its top, and he named that place Beth-El. However, Luz was the city's name originally. Then Jacob took a vow, saying, if God will be with me, will guard me on this way that I am going, will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I return in peace to my father's house, and Adonai will be a God to me. Because he was a God to Abraham, he was a God of Isaac, and if he'll also be the God of Jacob, if he'll be my God, then this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall become a house of God, and whatever you will give me, I shall repeatedly tithe to you. Now, I want to point out something to you, and I'm going to take a little break from the passage for a moment, a little rabbi trail. And what you see there it is. Thank you, Tim. What you see on the screen is a two-page spread of what's called the Chumash. And that's what I read from when we're studying the Torah. How many of you have a Chumash, especially the art scroll? Oh, see all these hands? Now, if you don't have one, you need to get one. And I should have mentioned this when we first started Genesis, but we're going to continue right on through Deuteronomy over the course of of next year. But this is how it is laid out. You've got a two-page spread, and over here on the right, this is the Hebrew text. This is the Hebrew over here on the right. Now down here, you probably won't use this much. This is also in Hebrew, but this is Rashi's commentary. Of all the great commentators, the Jewish commentators of the Torah, Rashi is considered to be the best. He lived back in the, I think, 1100s and in Italy, and his commentary is still studied daily all over the world. But this is all in Hebrew, all right? But you can get an English translation of that. Okay. Now, down here, below that, is all commentary in English. And you'll see a lot of quotes from Rashi and by other commentators. All of this section over here is also English commentary. And you'll have quotes from all the great rabbis and the sages over the last several thousand years. You'll even have quotes from by Gamaliel, who was St. Paul's rabbi. Okay? Now, this up here at the top of the left-hand page, this is the English translation of the Hebrew. So it corresponds with this over here. So the Hebrew text on the right, English translation on the left. And if there are six verses on the right, they'll have the same six verses translated in English on the left. So you can go back and forth. But then you've got this little column right here, which is also in Hebrew letters. But this is the Aramaic, and that's what I want to point out to you today. This is the Aramaic translation. It's called the Targum, and this is the Targum that was done by Onkelos. And Onkelos was a convert to Judaism. He was actually Italian. He was a Roman. But he became a convert to Judaism, and he's the one who refined and made sure this was accurate. Now, why do they have the Aramaic here? Aramaic is very similar to Hebrew, but Aramaic language came from basically Babylon in that area. Why do they include that? This is the reason. This Aramaic translation is actually the oldest commentary on the Torah in existence. Because you see, when they translated the Torah into Aramaic, they actually translated words certain ways to bring out the meaning. And so when we read the Aramaic, if you get a good translation of it, it actually comments and gives you insight about how the ancient rabbis, ancient sages of Israel, and the people in Yeshua's time understood the Torah. Okay? So that's what that is. Now, are you going to be reading the Aramaic? Probably not until you really know Hebrew well. I don't read Aramaic. A lot of the words are very similar. But I want to point out something to you. We're going to take this section here, and we're going to blow it up below. Okay, so here we are. Now, we just read from chapter 28, and in verse 20, you come to, this is verse 20 that starts right here. That's that letter means 20. And this is what it says in Genesis 28, then Jacob took a vow saying, if God will be with me, will guard me on this way that I am going, give me bread to eat, clothes to wear, and so on. And right there is where it says, im he will be, im yiyeh, if he will be. And there's the word Elohim. Now here's the interesting thing. Over here in the Aramaic, it has a different word. The word is Mimra. Mimra. How many of you remember the name, the word Mimra? If you've been with us in Torah cycles before, okay, a few of you. This is going to be new for most of you. Mimra. This is very, very interesting because you know what the Aramaic word Mimra means? It means word. So though the verse says they heard, here's an example, Genesis 3:8. They do this all the time in the Aramaic. Genesis 3:8, here's an example. They heard the voice of Adonai Elohim walking in the garden. This is what the Aramaic says. They heard the voice of the Mimra Elohim walk in the garden. They took the word Adonai and they substituted the word Mimra, which means word. Now, nobody knows for sure why they did this. And by the way, you know, there's a scriptural background to why the Hebrew is translated Aramaic. It has to do with the Jews when they came out of the Babylonian exile. They came back to Jerusalem, and under Ezra and Nehemiah, they rebuilt the temple. Remember, they discovered a Torah scroll in the temple. And so Ezra, who was a priest, he had the people on Sukkot. They had them all gathered. They stood. He made a blessing, began to read the Torah. And this is what it says. You can read it in Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8. It says, they read from the Torah scroll, from the Torah of God, translating to give the sense so that they understood the reading. The people who came out of Babylon knew Aramaic better than they did Hebrew, because that's what they were speaking in Babylon for 70 years. So when they came back, the Hebrew wasn't as clear. So when they would read a verse in Hebrew, then Ezra or one of the people would translate it into Aramaic. Then they'd read the next verse and then translate to Aramaic. And that tradition is going on. And that's why in the Chumash, you've got the Aramaic right next to the Hebrew. But in this Aramaic, they often take a word for God and they translate it Mimra. Here are a few more examples. There are many. Genesis 3:8 is the first one. Here's another one from Genesis 9:17. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between my Mimra and all flesh is on the earth. And your translation says between me. And the Aramaic says between my word and all the flesh on the earth, my Mimra. Genesis 15:6. Talk about Abraham. It says, then he believed in Adonai, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. But this is what it says in the Aramaic. Then he believed in the Mimra, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. He believed in the word. You see how the word Mimra is used as a stand-in for God himself? Genesis 17:7, I will establish my covenant between my Mimra and you. And your translation says, between myself, between me and you. And your descendants after you throughout their generations. And then we come to chapter 28 that we just read. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if Mimra will be with me, if your word, instead of saying Elohim, instead of God is with me, if Memra, if your word is with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food and so on. This goes on throughout the Torah over and over, not in every place where God's name or the word Elohim is used. And they seem to be kind of random. Nobody quite knows why. But anyone who has been a student of the Torah in Hebrew, raised in synagogue, raised in yeshiva, is aware of this. And they see the word Memra over and over and over and over again. The word standing in for God himself. Now, with that in mind, you come to John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word. Now, this is written in Greek, so they use the word logos. But what was John thinking in his mind? Memra. In the beginning was the Memra. The Memra was with God. The Memra was God. And then he goes on to tell us about how the Memra, the Word, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld him, and he was light. What he's saying is every place you see that word Memra in the Torah, that's like Yeshua, who's the Word made flesh. When you read about Memra, think of Yeshua. Think of Yeshua, God using his word, using his Aleph and Omega, his Aleph Tav, Yeshua is the word. He's the communication through which God speaks. He's through which God creates the world. And so John is strengthening this connection between the Messiah and this Memra, which is already part of the mental furniture of the students at the time. It's kind of amazing. So I just wanted to point that out to you. And I'll continue to point these occurrences out as we come to them, if I remember to. But while we're in John 1:1, that which is the first verse of that chapter, go to the very last verse of John 1, verse 51, and look what it says. Now, this is the story of where Peter and Andrew have met Yeshua, and they're all excited. They think they found the Messiah, and then they run, and they get Philip, right? And they bring him, Nathanael. And Nathanael's asleep under a tree, kind of like Jacob was asleep. And they go, they get Nathanael, they bring, they say, we found the Messiah, And Nathanael's very doubtful. And so when Yeshua sees Nathanael come, he says, oh, I saw you while you were still asleep under the fig tree. Nathanael's just blown away. And he says, oh, certainly you must truly. He says, you are the Son of God. You're the King of Israel. And Yeshua answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, you believe? You'll see greater things than these. And he says this, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Where do we see that language? Back in Genesis 28. In Jacob's dream, what did he see? He saw a ladder and the angels ascending and descending on the ladder. Nathanael wakes up, is brought to Yeshua. And Yeshua tells him, oh, you'll see the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Yeshua is saying what? That ladder, it's me. That symbol is me. The thing that connects heaven to earth is me. And the way God speaks to the earth is through me. And the way people ascend to God is through me. And whenever you think of that ladder, you think of me. He's taken that image and saying, I'm the fulfillment of it. Now, that's a pretty gutsy thing to say if you're not the Messiah. It's like C.S. Lewis said, you know, you can't just say that Yeshua was a good man. No good man comes along and makes such a claim unless he really is the Messiah or just a brazen liar. A madman. I choose to believe he's really the Messiah. The word angel means messenger. I think these are probably angelic beings, but I think everyone, everything God does as he communicates and even created the world, it was through Messiah, through his word. And as people come to him, Yeshua says, no one comes to the Father except by me. He's the ladder. He's the connector. He's the mediator between God and man. And, you know, in Hebrews, the writer there early on in the book says, let us consider the apostle and high priest. Let's consider the apostle and the high priest, who is Yeshua. What's the difference between an apostle, shaliach, and a high priest? A shaliach means to be sent. Apostle is one who's apostello, he's sent by God. Was Yeshua sent by God? Absolutely. Sent to do what? To communicate God to us, to bring the gospel to us, bring salvation to us. What's a high priest's job? Take man and represent man to God. Bring his offerings up to God to teach people how to approach God. You okay? So you can think of the apostles, the one who's going down, the high priest is the one going up. Yeshua is both. He's the apostle and the high priest of our confession, of our faith. This is why when you read Yeshua's words, half of what he has to say, he speaks almost as if he is God. And the other half of the things he says, he speaks as if he's just a man like you and me. Why? Because half the things he has to say, he's speaking as an apostle, as God speaking. The other half, he's speaking as a man, as a priest speaking. You know, speaking to God, show us how to pray to God, how to approach him. It works both ways. He's the apostle and high priest. He's the place where we ascend and descend. He's the ladder. It goes both directions. See the picture? So I didn't even mean to get into this other part here about the high priest and apostle, but it goes along with it. I just want you to have that image and think of him both ways. It might help you understand what seem to be contradictory statements that Yeshua makes. He talks about the Father is greater than me. Then on the other hand, he'll say, if you've seen what I do, see me, you've seen the Father. Well, one's an apostolic statement, one's a high priestly statement. Okay? So if you don't understand that, we'll talk about it at Beit Midrash tonight. Okay, let's move on a bit more. In verse 5, it says, then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Padan Aram. Now, this is part of the end of last week's Torah portion, but I want to bring up something about Laban and about the place where he lived. Laban was an Aramean, like his father Bethuel. So Jacob went to Padan Aram. Aram, it means an elevated place. Padan means like plain. So these are like an elevated plain. It must have been like a high plain area. I've never been to Padan Aram, but he went to Padan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel, the Aramean. There you have the word Aram again. Now, there are some things to be revealed about this character Laban when we look at his name. You've probably heard me say before that when you take the name Laban and spell it backwards, it becomes Nabal or Naval, which means fool. And then when you take the word Aram and spell it backwards, it becomes Mara, to be rebellious. So, Laban, the name means white, but spelled backwards, it means fool. Aram means elevated, but backwards, it means rebellious. So if you go by Laban's name, it's all white. He's elevated. I mean, Laban in his own, he had a very high opinion of himself. If you've read the portion, he thought he was way up there. He thought he could just cheat Jacob, control his daughters, marry one off in the place of the other. He thought he was in charge. He was above everything, and he was just pure as the driven snow. But he's really just a rebellious fool. That was his essence. So here's a question. Why in the world did Jacob submit to this for 20 years? Jacob knew that Laban was a fool, that he was a cheat. that he was a miser, that he was rebellious. He did not really recognize the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's God. Why did he submit to him? Now, here's a question for you. Have you ever had a boss that's a fool and a rebel, a cheat, self-centered? I think if you're a believer, all of us are assigned to be, you know, an employee of one of those bosses sometime in our life. Because God uses Labans all the time in our lives. What would have happened to Jacob if he had said, enough of this, I'm out of here. I know I'm supposed to be working for Rachel. I'm not doing this. I'm leaving. I'll go find a woman somewhere else. He wouldn't have had his 12 sons. He would not have had his wealth. He would not have had his name changed from Jacob to Israel. He would have missed all the blessings and all the work God did in his soul if he had not submitted to the hand of this rebellious fool. We need to learn to submit to the authorities God puts into our lives, even if they are not godly authorities. Because we need to be like Jacob, who realized, okay, Laban is not a godly man. He's very foolish. He's a cheat. He's a miser. He's a rebel. But God sent me here. He looked above the authority of Laban to the ultimate authority and realized, until I have permission from God to leave, I stay. And finally, when did Jacob leave? When God told him, now it's time to go home. But we tend to pride ourselves, well, I'm not staying in this job with this fool being my boss. And God's thinking, oh boy, I just got to find another fool to be his boss then, you know? Let me show you something, because this is not something I'm making up. I want you to consider this. Okay, here's Jacob. Here's Jacob, poor old Jacob. Man, did he suffer. Here's Jacob. So, first of all, he runs away from his brother Esau, whose name is also what? Edom, right? His name was also Edom. And what does Edom mean? It means red. And it's spelled like this in Hebrew. Aleph, Dalet, Vav, Mem. Edom. So he leaves Edom, he leaves Esau, and then who does he hook up with? Who does God put him under authority to? Laban. What does Laban's name mean? White. There's no coincidence that their names are colors. And then here's Laban's name. It's Lamed Beit Nun. And Jacob, he's between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, Esau wants to kill him. On the other hand, Laban wants to squeeze him dry. He wants to get everything, all the work, all the service, all the prosperity he can squeeze out of Jacob he possibly can. Sound like your life at times? You sound like, if I go this way, it's just the enemy. If I go over here, it's still just the enemy. And don't get, you have to understand, Esau, he was Jacob's enemy. Laban was too. Even though he was his father-in-law, even though he tried to always make it sound like, oh, I'm really doing you a favor here, Jacob. But he had two enemies. I want you to notice something. Take the first letter of Edom and the first letter of Laban. And what does it spell? El, God. It was God all along. It was God all along. And God was using Laban to bring incredible change to Jacob's soul, to mature him, to break him, to grow him, and to bring incredible blessing. Jacob had plans to marry one woman. God gave him four. If he just stayed married to Rachel, he'd have had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. That's plenty, because they were godly men, good men. But God says, no, I want you to have 12. And then when God finally says, okay, time to leave, go on back. Oh, here comes Esau with 400 men on horseback riding at him. He's coming to kill me. But what happens when they meet? They embrace. There's peace. And Jacob gives Esau this incredible blessing. But right before he meets Esau, Jacob's name is changed to Israel. Jacob means a grasper, a usurper. And he was born grasping Esau's heel. Israel means either prince of God or straight to God. There's that L again at the end. That's the same word here. And you see, your story is the same as Jacob's, because everything that God's doing in your life to squeeze you, to break you, the fools he brings in your life to bring torment to you, it's always to accomplish the process of turning you from a Jacob into an Israel. And if you're allowing God to wrestle with you, if you're allowing God to break you, if you're learning to submit to the authorities he brings into your life, then you're a child of Israel, a son of Israel. Nowhere are the Gentiles called children of Jacob, but we are called, if we're believers in him, and allowing him to operate in our lives, are called children of Israel. Okay? He was born Jacob, but he's reborn Israel. And birth is a painful process. Kind of amazing, isn't it? It's all just right there in Genesis. Well, let's go on. Let's talk about the wives of the children. As you know, Jacob works 7 years to marry Rachel. They have the big wedding, and he goes into the honeymoon tent. It must have been very dark in there. And in the morning, he gets up and realizes it's the wrong woman. It's Rachel's sister, Leah. And so he goes to Laban. He says, what have you done? He says, well, to give the marry off the younger before the older, that's not what we do here. In other words, Jacob, I know what you did. You're the younger brother. You got the birthright. You got the blessing. That's not what we do here. The older gets it. This is why Jacob clams up, because God has brought on his own head kind of his own conniving and plotting. Interesting, huh? In Hebrew, there's a word for the, a phrase for this. It's midah keneged midah, measure for measure. And I always try to tell my kids, I think they're starting to believe it, but I always told them, you know, you never get away with anything. Nobody ever gets away with anything. Oh, there may be a space of time between the crime and the punishment, but there's always a consequence to everything we do. There's also a reward for every good thing we do. It's always measure for measure, every single time. But that's another story. So, Leah, God blesses her, opens her womb, but not Rachel. And so she has a son, Reuben, which means there's the word son at the end of the word. Ra means to see a son. And then Simeon comes the word Shema, to hear, because God has heard her prayer. And then she thinks, okay, three sons. Jacob's heart's really going to be connected to me. And that's what the word Levi means. It means connected, to be hooked together. And then finally, she has a fourth son, Yehuda, which comes the word Hod. We sing that song, Hodu, Ladonai, you know, okay? Hodu, praise the Lord. And it's got Hod right there in the middle three letters. It means he will be praised. Well, Rachel's desperate, so she pulls a Sarah. It's like Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham. Rachel gives her maid Bilhah to Jacob, and Bilhah conceives. She has a son named Dan. Dan means judge. Daniel means Dani, my judge is El, or judge of God. And Naphtali, my wrestling, So Leah says, well, I'm going to get on in on this too. So she gives her handmaid to Jacob. Her handmaid's name is Zilpah. Zilpah has two children, Gad, which means good fortune, and Asher, which means happy. This is why, you know, Psalm starts out with the word Ashrei Ha'ish, happy is the man, blessed is the man. That's the word Asher. So Leah's had four sons, Bilhah's had two, Zilpah's had two, and still Rachel, zero. Well, then God opens Leah's womb again, and she has two more sons, Issachar and Zebulun. This woman who Jacob did not want turns out having half of his sons. Six of the 12 sons come out of the woman he didn't want. And you know what? I can think of things in my life I didn't want, things I tried to avoid, but God brought into my life anyway. And I'm so glad he did, because they've borne such fruit in my life and such blessing for me. Can some of you say the same thing in your own life? It's the way God works. Finally, God opens Rachel's womb, and she has a son named Joseph. And when she's pregnant with Benjamin, that's when Jacob takes off. God tells Jacob, but actually, right after Joseph was born, not too long after, the next verse, you see Jacob prepares to leave Laban. There had to be a little time there, though, because by the time he's ready to leave, Rachel's pregnant a second time, this time with Benjamin, the 12th of Jacob's 12 sons. Now, as you know, Joseph is such a key figure in the book of Genesis. And after Jacob is off the scene, the whole rest of the book is about Joseph. It focuses on him, and no person in the entire Bible and the Hebrew scriptures is a more accurate picture, detailed picture of Messiah than is Joseph. No wonder Yeshua is called Yeshua ben Yosef, because Mary's husband, Yeshua's adopted father, his name is Joseph, because Yeshua and Joseph, they were like parallels, or like twins. And so we're going to see so many things about Joseph, starting with his name. I want you to look at how he was named. Here's the passage in Genesis 30, verses 23 to 24. So she, Rachel, conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away Asaf. He's taken away my reproach. She named him Yosef, saying, may Adonai add Yasaf to me another son. Now, this word Asaf and the word Yasaf are two different verbs, but almost identical. We usually translate it as to add, but it's not really what they mean. They all have almost identical meanings. And when you look at the definitions, they're almost the same. I don't even know why there are two verbs. I don't know, but there are. But Asaf and Yasaf basically mean to gather. To gather. When you gather things, you can gather things to take them away, or you can gather things you want to keep. Like if it's time to wash clothes, what do you gather all the dirty clothes and you take them away. But if you probably wouldn't do this, but let's just say you're all sinners, all right, and a Brinks truck wrecks and there's cash flying up into the air, all right, all these $100 bills, you would gather them to give them all back, right? But you would gather them, and there's something that's precious, you gather it to keep. But other things you gather to take away. So what has she said? Now look at the context again. God has Asaf, he's taken away, he's gathered up my reproach and taken it away. Until I had a child, I was just a reproach. I felt like I was under God's curse, because a woman in the Middle East, in ancient times especially, her purpose in life has become a mom, to bring forth children, hopefully sons that can carry on the husband's name. And if you didn't have a child after a period of 10 years, legally in Israel, a husband could divorce his wife. He could just divorce her. Nobody would even ask questions. But she just felt like she's under reproach. So God gathered away her reproach. But then she says, may Adonai gather to me another son. May he add to me another son. Take this away. Take away my reproach. But bring in another child. The same word means, has these two connotations. So she names him Yosef. Now, how is this like Yeshua? Oh, by the way, here's an example. One of my favorite verses that uses this word, Asaph. You see it there in the middle. Those three letters, those are the root. For my father and my mother have forsaken me. Psalm 27:10. For my father and my mother have forsaken me. In other words, they've died. They've gone. I'm an orphan. But Adonai will gather me in. I love that. I love that. There's a book out called The Lord Will Gather Me In. And it's by a Jewish man who is not particularly observant. But when his father died, he purposed to go and say Kaddish for him every single day for the year. You know, the Kaddish is the prayer of praise to God for the life of someone who's deceased. We do it here during the liturgy every Shabbat morning. And he was determined, he did. He wrote a book of his experiences and his closest to God and memories of his father over the period of a year. And he called it, The Lord Will Gather Me In. It's a really interesting book that I read many years ago. So, again, back to Joseph. In what way has Yeshua taken away, and in what way has he added? You know that ladder where they come down, they go up and up and down, and he's the apostle, and he's the high priest. Yeshua, everything he does is dual. Well, in John 1:29, we spent a lot of time in the first chapter of John this morning, haven't we? It says, the next day saw Yeshua coming to him and said, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. That's one of his jobs, to gather our sins, take them away, and dump them. 1 John 3:5, you know that he appeared in order to take away sins. But what else did he do? Why else did he come? It's hinted at here in Hebrews 2:10-13. For it was fitting for him for whom are all things and through whom are all things. Here's that duality again. Everything is for him, but everything is also through him. There you have the up the ladder and you have down the ladder. And in bringing many sons to glory. There we go. He wants to gather in many sons to glory. He wants to bring many. So he gathers sins to take them away, but he gathers the sons, the children, to bring them in. To perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one Father. Which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. These quoting passages. Now, if you really want to understand this passage of Hebrews, you have to go to each of those passages and read the whole paragraph and the whole context. But then again, he quotes a third place. Behold, I and the children whom God has given me. This is a great passage from Isaiah. And in the chapter that it's from, I think it's Isaiah 5, if I'm not mistaken. Isaiah 55. In Isaiah 55, what you see is God about to bring judgment on Israel. But Isaiah goes on to say, but I'm going to stand strong. Isaiah had five sons, one of them named Emmanuel. He says, we're going to stand strong. I and the sons, the children God's given me, we're going to stand for him. So we see these two aspects of Joseph's name when he's named, reflecting the two aspects of Yeshua's work. To take away sins, but then to bring children into God's kingdom. Just as Rachel prayed, God has gathered away my reproach. May he gather to me another child, another son. See the picture, the parallels? The gospel is all through the book of Genesis. All through. I guess I'm all through. And we have a few minutes left, comments and questions. So I could see the wheels turning. Carla has her hand up. So let's get a microphone to Carla back here.
Getting back to the Memra thing.
Yes.
Psalm 138, verse 2. Do you have that you could read it?
I can look it up. Psalm 138, verse 2.
Thanks.
No, I don't have it in Hebrew. Is that what you're going to ask about?
One of the words, yes. I did want to ask you about it in Hebrew.
I will bow down toward your holy temple and give thanks to your name for your loving kindness and your truth. For you have magnified your word according to all your name.
The translation that I have says, you have exalted your word above your reputation. And I wondered what the Hebrew actually says.
I wish I had it with me. I do not.
Okay, thanks.
So, sorry about that. That's a good Beit Midrash question, though. I will have everything there then. Well, that's a great verse. It's magnified his word above his name or according to all your name. Yeah. All right, who else? And Tim.
Something you'd said earlier about that Yeshua is both apostle and priest.
Yes.
And how in one sentence he'll say one thing that sounds like an apostle.
Hold that right there for a second. Let me just read the verse to you. I should have printed it out. It just kind of occurred to me while I was up here. So it's in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Yeshua, the apostle and high priest of our confession. So it's Hebrews 3, 1. Okay, go ahead, Tim.
It helps me to maybe make sense of something that I've been trying to understand for a while that is in our Siddur.
Okay.
And it's how things are worded. And it's strange how it moves from second person to third person, or first person to third person. So I just found an example here on page 52. And it shall be, if you diligently obey my commandments, which I am commanding you today, to love Adonai your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, that I will give rain for your land at its proper time. So it's other ways too, in the scripture too, it just moves kind of from,
it does.
Holy are you, and then right into, I have commanded you. Like, it's like, okay, who's that one command? Like this shift, but it helps, that helps us to make sense that in that message, there is both the message that goes up and the message that comes down.
Yeah, that's a good point. You find that so many of the places where God speaks, and Psalm 91 is a great example. Read Psalm 91. It's hard to keep up with who's speaking and who's being spoken to. And this is very very common when God is speaking. Because if God is everywhere, he speaks from the outside in, he speaks from the inside out, he speaks from above and below and left and right and front and back. And God is spirit, and in the world of the spirit, there's no geography. Everything's one. There's not this division. But in the world of language, there is. There's past, there's future, there's you, there's me, there's plural, there's singular. There's all this division. In the spiritual realm, it's like the divisions all kind of mooshle together. The walls all kind of go down. And you find that very much in Hebrew and to a degree in the Greek as well. It's hard to keep up often with who's speaking, who's being spoken to when God is communicating. Yeah. I don't know if that made any sense at all to anybody. But we can talk about, we have a lot to talk about tonight. David, and then I see Jim, and then Walt. Or actually, we'll do Walt after Dave because you're right here close.
Grant, just another connection between two of your main topics today, which is the word and the way that names can be read forward and backward, and that the Hebrew words often are communicating opposite ideas within themselves. And so I've been listening to a teacher online, and one of her points recently was that everything in this world is a mixture of good and evil. Everything has that positive side to it. Everything has a negative side. Every name that we hear you talk about or we study, you can see it on in this way, you can see it in that way. And the connection with the Word is such an appropriate introduction because it is the sword of the Word, which is double-edged, that helps us to differentiate every single thing, yeah, what is good in it and what, yes, is evil in it, the good side and the evil side.
That's so true. Just like us, we all have great potential for either. And you know, when we bless our children, we have our little boys, our little girls up here, may God make you like Sarah. The Sarah who gave Hagar, her handmaid, to her husband to have a baby with. The Sarah then had that baby and that handmaid driven out. The Sarah who lied and says, I wasn't laughing. And she was laughing. That's Sarah. And may he make you like Rebecca. Really? Rebecca said, listen, Jacob, your dad's getting ready to bless your brother. I want you to get the blessing. So you dress in his clothes, put this hair on here, and you know, and I'll help make the food. Just do what we want to make our girls like her. And Rachel. And Leah. Leah, you don't see anything really wrong with her, but you see there are a couple things there. When she basically went out and hired her husband with the Dudaim, the mandrakes that Reuben found in the field. That's not too cool. And then it was her daughter, Dinah, went out in the field and then met Shechem. And you know how that all blew up. So, I mean, you see these four women. We asked God to make our daughters like them. And they were very imperfect women. But when you come to the end of their lives, God had refined them so much. And it's what you are when you come to the end that matters. And if we ask God to make our daughters like those women, that means God, even though our daughters will make mistakes, they're going to be recorded in your book and they will be a blessing to others. So there's a lot of good there. But you're so right, David. You're so right that we're all a mixture. We're all a mixture. Speaking of the word word, I have to share this. You know, the Hebrew word for word is devar. And everything's a ladder. Everything's dual. Everything's double. Yeshua, he's like a menorah. There's a left and a right. You know, apostle, high priest. Everything's a perfect balance. Well, if you look at the letters, Dalet, Beit, Resh, you see that the middle letter is 2. Beit has a numerical value of 2. Dalet has a numerical value of 4, which is 2 squared. Resh has a value of 200. Everything about the word devar is about 2s. Because his word, you have the letter and you have the spirit, right? You've got these two levels. And there are positive commandments. There are negative commandments. We have the Hebrew scriptures. We have the Greek scriptures. The Yeshua right in the middle. Everything is duality. Everything is a menorah. Everything is in the balance and a reflection and a pair. And we have to look at the word of God in that way. And even the word for word reflects this. So anyways, didn't mean to get off on that. That should get time for the microphone to go to Walt. Go ahead, Walt.
This is not a deep spiritual question.
How do I get this feeling that it's going to be a deep spiritual question? Would you say that?
When I got married, I knew who my bride was.
Oh, yeah?
When I woke up the next morning, I still knew who she was.
Yeah.
I don't understand what happened between Laban and Rachel to Jacob. I mean, was he so drunk?
Basically.
I just don't know what happened. It just seems like, did he show up for the wedding?
Yeah. It's, first of all, they were sisters, so they probably looked very similar. She would have been in the tent waiting for him when he entered. And it would have been completely, totally dark in there. And so her voice would have sounded like Leah's. And physically, she would have been very similar to Leah. The difference it points are to Rachel. The thing it says about Leah is her eyes were, and it gives a strange word. Nobody knows exactly what it means. Her eyes are weak, or they were sensitive, or they were blue. We don't know what it was. Well, in the dark tent, you're not going to be seeing what's in her eyes. You're not going to see that giveaway mark of Leah. But there are other questions I have. But why did Leah go along with it? And so on and so forth. But what a horrible morning that must have been. Oh. It had to have been a Monday. Oh, I know. I often think about that. It's like, I don't even like to think about it. It has been so awful. But it was God's will. The blessing. And you know, if you go to where Jacob is buried in Hebron, guess who's buried next to him? Not Rachel. Leah is. Rachel was Jacob's choice. Leah was God's choice. Maybe not as attractive, but fertile, fruitful, and so filled with blessing. So, you know, yeah, you're welcome. But, oh, yes, now Jim.
At the time Jacob or Israel was having... at the time he was establishing the tribes,
yes,
of Israel, was tribes or sons being established at that time through Esau?
Yes. Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, Esau. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, Esau also had a bunch of sons. Which one had 12? Ishmael had 12 sons. But you'll find Esau's descendants mentioned back earlier, and I think there's more commentary later on as we get to further into Genesis. But yeah, he's building up his house as well with a number of wives. Yeah, and then he intermarries with Ishmael. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. You know what? All right, it's four after. Should we have one more quick question? We can have one more. Bob, did I see your hand up? Okay. And Lance, do you have any questions back there? Any comments? No? You're all good? All right. Well, Bob, we'll give you the last word then.
If anyone lived up to the definition of their name, it was certainly Joseph.
Yeah.
Reading in verse 48, he gathered all food of the 7 years that came to pass in the land of Egypt, and he placed food in the cities, the food of the field around each city he placed within it. Joseph amassed grain like the sand of the sea in great abundance until he ceased counting, for there was no number.
Yeah.
He was certainly a gatherer.
Oh, yes, definitely. Which verse is that? Is that chapter 48?
Chapter 41.
I'm sorry, 41.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the word there is also Asaph.
41:48.
Yeah, that looks more like it. So 41:48. And there he goes. You know, it's a different word. So anyway, so it shows what I know. Well, it should be Asaph. That's what it should be.
But then I think also of Yeshua.
Actually, the word there, interesting, it's the word kibbutz. That's where we get the word kibbutz, okay? He kibbutzed all the food. So it's kind of interesting.
So Joseph amassed food for a certain people group for a certain time.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, we have Yeshua amassing the peoples of the world to the, yeah, Father.
That's so true.
Also gathering.
Good insight, Bob. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. All right. Well, let's close a word of prayer, and then we'll have Tim come up and lead us in the blessing. Our Father and King, thank you so much for the preciousness of your word. Lord, help us to see more deeply into it as you continue to open our eyes to behold wonders from it. Thank you for Yeshua. Thank you for the story and the illustrations we have about him in the lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And thank you, Father, that you are such a God that you can take fools in our lives, wicked authorities, rebels, and even use them to accomplish your purpose in each one of us. Lord, help us to be more faithful and trusting in you, to realize you're bigger than the pain that we experience, and that you run the world. So, Father, help us to see beyond the immediate suffering we may be going through right now, and see you on the other side as the one who is working all things for our good. And we praise you for being just the way you are, doing just what you do and how you do it. We praise you so much for all of these things. In Yeshua's name, amen. Well, let's stand together. Tim?